Hey everyone, good morning. Thanks for coming. We're here today to talk about getting unstuck. And thanks so much for coming out so early and on a Monday morning. Really appreciate it. I'm here with my lovely panel, who I'll be introducing in a second. But first, I wanted to ask you guys, how many people here are, you know, here today at 10 in the morning because you feel like you're stuck? Okay, we have about 3/4 of a stuck audience. And then how many people are just curious what unstuck even means? And how many people couldn't get into the panel next door? Okay, that's all right. We'll have something for you too. So what I want to do today, first, we're going to have a long discussion with the panel. We're also going to have you guys get involved. We want to make this an interactive panel because we're unstuck here at the front of the room. But first, I want to set some ground rules and definitions for what unstuck means. So to start out, what we want to talk about is breaking free of old ways of thinking. We want to talk about how we can take risks and make changes, how we can take some chances, convince our clients to take some chances with us while making them feel comfortable and happy. We want to break free of some of the old processes that we're so used to relying on. They're so comfortable, like those bedroom slippers that we are so fond of. We want to figure out how to get out of the rut, how to break free, work more efficiently, avoid the same thing over and over. It's like that proposal that you submit to the client and it has the list of deliverables. And when you get to the third deliverable, you realize that, you know what, it really wasn't necessary anyway, but we're going through this process because we promised it. And so there are these ways that we're sort of mired in these standards and these processes that we're so so comfortable with. So inspiration is also a big part of getting unstuck. And it's how do we get inspired at the right time? How do we start adapting to new ways of thinking about getting inspired? And if anyone had seen the Field Guide to Inspiration on Saturday, Jason and Rob talked a lot about getting inspired as an individual. How do we work together as with designers, developers, marketers, any kind of person in a process? How are we working together happily? And how are we going to get unstuck? Before we answer all of these questions and more, I wanted to give credit to a woman named Kelly Godo. This is actually Kelly Godo's panel. My name is Liz Danzico. I'm filling in for Kelly because she couldn't be here today, but I wanted to give her credit for putting together this awesome group of people. So
she's our common factor.
Yes,
she is. And she's also working on a process for getting unstuck that you might see later on. So unstuck has a lot to do with perspective, right? Those of you who are already stuck know that you're stuck because there's not a clear way out. I want to talk about some of the reasons why that's the case. You show this photo to a New Yorker, right? What do you think the New Yorker is going to say? Traffic looks pretty good. It's all clear, right? And you go one state over to Pennsylvania, you show it to a Pennsylvanian, and that person's going to say it looks a lot like a traffic jam. There's a stuck problem here, the quintessential stuck problem. And so not only is there a perspective problem where it's very tied to the experiences you've had in the past where you're sitting in the city or on a team, but it's also there are also scales at work here, right? There's a person sitting in that car. There's a passenger. There's a taxi driver who has a different perspective. There's a city, a system problem, perhaps, that's causing a traffic jam. And so when you're working on a team, you have these same kind of scale issues, right? You as a person might be stuck. Your team might be stuck. Your entire company might be stuck. There are these all these different levels. And we could talk about all of them, and then we'd sort of be here at least all day, if not more. So for the purposes of today's discussion, I really want to limit that scope a bit, because over the course of the weekend and today and tomorrow, you're going to hear a lot about inspiration as an individual, where to find it, who to look to, who are our heroes. Here in this session today, we're going to be talking about unstuck in these three ways: the actor process of doing good work, the actor process of being productive, and the actor process of feeling fulfilled in a team environment. And you guys know that there's so many definitions of teams these days, but what we're not talking about is writer's block, right? We're not talking about that blank sheet of paper and getting unstuck from that. There are lots of people you can talk to about that, but just not today. So team environment, okay? Just wanted to remind you what we kind of are used to in terms of a team environment. This is the typical waterfall method that we all love and hold so dearly. This is a diagram put together by Brandon Schauer from the Information Architecture Summit in 2006, just to show that, you know, there are new ways of working that we're trying to adapt to. There are models out there. Jason Fried last year at South by Southwest talked a lot about Get Real and these new ways of working because of the ways we're going to have to listen to our audience. We're baiting things earlier. People are using our products. We're getting feedback. And those users are determining our requirements. So how do we take our old system that we were comfortable with and bring in these new methods? Well, there are lots of answers, right? Process diagrams, process strategies, you know, methods galore. But it's not that easy. We can't just take a process, a book definition, and apply it to our team. Why? Because we have so many different levels of perception, so many different levels of scale, like the New York City traffic jam. So what works for us? What works for you? This is what we want to get to today. And we have these guys here. Scary slide. These guys here who come from all different walks of life, right? They all different kinds of team relationships that they are bringing expertise to you today. So I want to have them introduce themselves, and then we're going to kind of cut to you for a little bit and come back to the panel. So I'm the moderator, as I said, and I work for a company called Daylife, formerly worked at an organization called AIGA, and I'm here to ask hard questions. Luke W., to my right here, is our corporate monkey for the panel today. Luke, can you talk a little bit about what you
do? Sure. Yeah, well, I forgot my banana, so you guys will have to excuse me. But I'm the principal designer at Yahoo of social media, which means I spend the bulk of my time kind of helping our social media products find focus using design principles, design thinking, and sort of the actual design deliverables. So that means kind of two things. One is pulling all the data streams we have, both internally and externally, into something that sort of turns into a story that rallies a team. And the other one is really communicating that story via, like I said, design deliverables, artifacts, what have you.
Great. To Luke's right is Chris Messina. He's going to be our open source hombre for this morning. Chris?
Hi. I co-run a consulting company called Citizen Agency. Before that, I worked on a startup called Flock. And then prior to that, I was on the Mozilla project working on something called Spread Firefox that worked to market the Firefox browser. I also helped co-found Barcamp and am now working on something called Coworking.
Great. To Chris's right is Jeffrey Zeldman, who's our creative director on the panel. Jeffrey?
Hi, I'm a creative director at HappyCog, and I publish List Apart and design websites.
Etc. To Jeffrey's right is Christian Bengtsson, who's the integrator on our panel today.
Hello, I'm from Sweden, and actually my title as well is creative director. I'm an interaction designer for starters, and basically what I do is seeing to it that I get to focus on solutions in project, which basically means that I don't have to deal with the boring project stuff, so I can just focus on the quality of the solution, as well as trying to get people to communicate between the different teams and the organizations within the teams in the projects that we do. So basically, I guess I integrate the quality of the solution with the people within the teams in the project.
Great. Thanks, guys. So let's talk about what your role is in the panel, now that you know everyone's role here. So what we'd like to do today is, you know, you've been at South by Southwest now for, was there third or fourth day, depending, maybe longer, and you've seen a lot of panels. But we'd like to turn this into an interactive session. So most of you, I hope, on your chair got an index card when you came in. So if you didn't, and you want one, not quite sure about that, ask your neighbor. You could share, tear them in half. So what we're going to do is we're going to have what's called a lightning round. And because three quarters of you in this room suggested that you're stuck, we'd like you to actually write down your stuck scenario on your card if you want to. And the reason that we're not doing this as a microphone scenario is because a lot of people feel, you know, they don't want to say, I feel stuck, and this guy that paid for me to come here is actually my boss. And so we want it to be anonymous, or you can actually put your name down if you want to. But the panel here is going to respond to your stuck scenario to help you get unstuck on the fly in 1 minute. So we're going to have a lightning round of 1 minute starting in about 20 minutes or so. So we're going to have some discussions up here while you guys are sort of thinking of your scenarios. And there are some women in the audience that will be coming around, and I'll let you know when that is. And pass your cards to the center aisle. It'll all fall into place, believe me. Let me give you some examples of how what kinds of things you might talk about. So you might say something like, all we have is meetings, meetings, meetings. They never get us anywhere. There's no question because it has to be two sentences max. But it's implied. So you can keep it short, and we'll do our best. How do we set strategic goals when all senior leadership does is micromanage? Questions like this or any other scenario that you feel stuck in. We're here to help you get unstuck. So with that, I'd like to present my first question. And this is kind of a general question for the entire panel, which is, I'd like to hear a bit about your process. Keeping in mind that we're talking about stuck, it would be great to hear about your personal process in these different roles. So, Chris, can you start?
Sure, I can start. You know, I was thinking about this, and I had some other ideas that I was going to maybe talk about, but it dawned on me that actually the work that I do best tends to be out in the open and tends to be working with communities or individuals on projects that really matter to them. And in cases where I've been the most stuck, I find that actually what happens is I tend to close up. I tend to take all my ideas and basically put them in my own head and get really afraid, I guess, of putting them out there into the world. When I worked on the Spread Firefox project, one of the things that I did the best, I think, was I put all of my early ideas, sketches, designs, and everything that I could think of either out on a blog, out on a wiki, or on Flickr. In fact, that's how my design process worked. I was able to rally a bunch of designers from the community to also post their work, to take my screenshots, my mock-ups, and change them, and then put them back out on Flickr. Mm-hmm. And by actually having an extremely open process, by integrating people into everything that I did, I think we came up with a lot better solutions, a lot better ideas. We were able to actually get through a lot faster than, say, if I tried to figure out everything in my own head, in my own design space, on my own computer, and not share those things. So I guess for me, the best work that I do is actually when I get everything out there in the open as soon as early as possible. But I think actually Jeffrey has a different idea on that. That was brilliant.
I'm in client services, and I do, I guess I'd call it, management through conversation. I'll tell you how it got started, as I just figured this out, yesterday. The first website I worked on was Batman Forever, 1995, and there was another team that was also, in the running to do it. And they actually had expertise at building websites, and we were totally lying and had no expertise at all. And they showed their drawings first. They had these beautiful comps that they'd done, and then they were talking about what Batman was going to do, and they called it the Bat Trove, and Batman was going to swing down and say, "Hi, I'm Batman." And I blurted out, "Batman doesn't talk." Now, that was totally rude. I wasn't trying to be rude. It wasn't my turn to present. I should have just been shutting up, but I couldn't help it. They didn't understand Batman, and I just blurted out, "Batman doesn't talk." The client looked at me, and I knew in that moment that we had it, that we were going to get the account, because I understood Batman, and that was all that mattered. And we hid the drawings. We didn't show anything that we'd worked on because we didn't want to blow it by having worse drawings than the other team. So since that day, basically my process is to talk in client services is to talk quite a bit before we ever get to any design phase, so that there's a comfort level and a trust level. And I try to understand what people are actually saying, because everybody's indirect. You know, I'll say something to my wife, and I really mean, "I'd like you to do something for me," but I never say, "I'd like you to do something for me." I'll be like, "Does it seem cold in here? And that might mean, could you shut the window? I don't know. You know what I'm saying? This is how people are. So I know that's how people are. So I try to hear what people are actually saying. And the same with people I work with. I try to hear what they're actually saying. So I guess I have no process at all and no rules. I just try to listen. And that's what I do. And it seems to work pretty well because we, in client services, I find that we work a lot with companies who are kind of mired in processes and have all kinds of requirements, and they can't have a conversation without checking some boxes first. And we go through all these things with them, but the idea is to save them from whatever it is that they think they have to do and actually get them to do, in our case, because we do build websites, what their users need. So we try to get them to what their users need in spite of their process, which is about their organization and not at all about their users.
So at the risk of sounding premeditated, I actually think you guys are kind of hitting on a common theme towards some of the things that I use, which is this kind of continuous communication / feedback loop, yours with an external kind of community, yours with the client, just sort of an ongoing information in, information out sort of process. And the thing that I was going to add to that is my sort of methodology for continually staying sort of quote-unquote unstuck, if that actually is the case, is to always sort of be engaged with information flowing in. So, you know, any sorts of data I can get my hands on, I always try to absorb, staying up on what's happening in trends, both online, around, outside of the web, you know, in the world, and kind of having continuous flow of ideas, of thoughts, of exploration, and then putting that out there as well. Mm-hmm. So similarly to your experience, kind of putting things in the community, I've been writing a blog for 3-something years. Before that, I wrote a book. Before that, I was teaching. And sort of putting your ideas out there helps you get feedback on them. And when Chris and I were talking a second ago, I have like some notes I was writing down here, and you know, I was joking it was a cheat sheet, but my process is sort of, I write things down so that I can think them through, which I think is another one of those sort of feedback loops. Mm-hmm. When you write something down, you're sort of thought, you have to think it through, you have to make it more concise, you have to think about what am I actually trying to say, and that's a way to sort of refine your message so you can go communicate it back into that feedback loop. Again, it kind of keeps going in circles. And as soon as you sort of break that loop, if somebody walls up, or if a team sort of becomes entrenched and doesn't really want to communicate with other teams, things like that, that's when you sort of hit a stuck process. Mm-hmm. So I guess common theme that I'm hearing is communication. You guys can tell me if I'm off or not, but
I don't think you're off. What we try and do is try to accept that things are in constant change. And we also try to be fearless and have fun. And what I mean by that is this autumn, I listened to Malcolm McLaren that formed the Sex Pistols, and he put it pretty well. He said, it's better to be a flamboyant failure than a mediocre success. Mm. And we're not saying we're either, but we're trying to be flamboyant failures and for allowing for mistakes to happen. And we're constantly working on process. And today, or actually last week, we kind of formed this formula that's intention plus dialogue through context is what design means to us. So if it's any harder than that, we won't do it. Just keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah, well, I think you hit on an important point with this ability to fail. Sometimes, you know, if you look at, there's a great little book out there called The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. I don't know if anybody's read it. It's like a leadership parable. And you kind of have this soap opera drama about people in meetings. It's fascinating. But it pulls together a kind of model of how teams can become dysfunctional. At the base of it is an absence of trust. And the argument it makes around that absence of trust is people are sort of afraid to open up and show where they're weak, where they fail. But once you sort of start saying, okay, well, I don't know that, or hey, I need your help right here, that starts building trust upon which you can build an open environment for debate, upon which you can build shared goals, upon which you can build accountability, et cetera. And it all sort of stacks up from there. So if you're not able to sort of, I mean, I'm not saying like go out and like do really bad things and just so you can fail, but have some openness around which trust can be built.
Trust is huge. And another thing I'd just like to add, if I may, I heard Luke talking about putting stuff out there, publishing stuff. I think that's a great idea. Everybody can do that. You can put it on your blog. You can contribute to a magazine. You can write a book, maybe, or a chapter of a book. Almost everybody here does stuff like that. This is a very unusual group. But if your boss doesn't get what you do or doesn't get why usability or user-centered design or accessibility or website, whatever it is that's important, design, they don't understand why design is important, whatever it is. So you write a little article about it, or you, and then you maybe point them to another article that a colleague of yours or a friend from South by Southwest wrote and said, hey, did you see this in this magazine? They said design's really important. Just thought I'd share that with you. And you just keep putting it out there, and eventually you change the conversation. Eventually your ideas and other ideas gain traction, and the boss thinks it's their idea, and then you can do it.
You want them using the words you sort of establish. I mean, that, if you have the power to control words, that's huge. We've seen it with all sorts of memes that bubble up on the internet, etc. I think I'll shut up in a second, but I think it goes beyond sort of writing. It also goes to talking, right? So the key underlying theme is a story, a narrative. To take it to the corporate environment for a second, if you're stuck in the corporate environment, there's tons of groups out there doing very interesting things, and there's massive amounts of parallel sort of goals, insights that you can gain from them. So one of the best things to do in a corporate environment, if you're feeling stuck in your group, go talk to other groups. Hear what they're doing. You'll be surprised at how many things you can bring back to your group. Be like, hey, these guys are doing this thing. We should try this. We should try that.
Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, I think one of the other important things about getting ideas out there early, before they've cemented and before you feel that they're fully baked, is that it really gives a chance for other people to destroy your ideas and allow them to actually be reborn as something much better. And the things that I think are most important about that is that other people might be able to see into your blind spot. As well, coming from design, you sort of want to look at the negative space of an idea. You know, you might have a chunk or a kernel of something that sounds really, really great, but until you put it out there and talk to other people and explain it a million times, you don't really get the value of their feedback, of seeing, you know, and reading their faces and seeing, you know, how are they actually taking this in? Does this make sense to them? I think one of the most important and most powerful things about the Firefox movement, especially from a marketing perspective, is that the story of Firefox was so strong that we were able to get people to tell their own story about Firefox, about how they had installed it for their grandparents, you know, and it got rid of all the pop-ups, or they installed it on all their corporate computers, you know, in one day, and everybody, you know, didn't even notice, and all of a sudden everybody was happier or something. Mm-hmm. But what was really important is that you took this very, very simple idea. You allowed people in that conversation to actually affect what the idea was itself. So they took some ownership of it and they internalized it so that they understood it for themselves. And I think in terms of sort of getting unstuck, if you have a really good idea and people just aren't picking it up, getting it out there as soon as possible and letting people actually be part of it, and as Jeffrey sort of talks about, turn it into a conversation piece, is probably one of the best things to move things forward.
If I could add one tiny little thing. We live in a soundbite culture, and one of the problems John Kerry had, he had a lot of problems, but one of the problems John Kerry had was he would present these long, complex arguments that didn't lend themselves very well to a 2-second news clip. And so it could be taken out of context or whatever. People weren't sure what he was saying, even if it was clear if you read the long thing. Like Lincoln talked that way, and that was cool in Lincoln's time, but it didn't work on CNN.
Four-score.
So the same thing with people you work with. If you can kind of think of a sound bite. You don't have to write an article, publish anything. If you can just think of simple ways of, like you do in your family, like say, let's have dinner like a family. And you start saying like a mantra, let's have dinner like a family. And eventually you all start having dinner like a family because mom keeps saying that, and then dad starts saying it, and family has dinner. So this is kind of the same thing. If you can articulate a goal about yourself, about your project, and keep it really simple, and kind of use that over and over again. It may sound manipulative and like you're trying to hypnotize the person, but it actually works. Then it becomes what everybody's trying to achieve. A lot of times people are working and they're so busy working, they don't know what they're trying to achieve. They lose track of that and they're just focused on working. I've got to get all these pages done. I've got to write all this code, whatever it is. But if there's actually a goal of, you know, a simple user-based goal or a simple brand goal that you're trying to achieve, and you just keep saying it over and over, everybody can kind of get on board.
I think it can be, I'm going to do one little thing. I think it can even be as simple as just a name. Naming something goes a really long way to get people talking about it.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how I work with ideas and writing, because I think I have like 1,000 ideas in my head. And I actually realized that once I write them down or sketch them down, maybe 1%, if I'm lucky, is good enough to even present to the open public and then to be butchered. So I think it's for the personal process of just trying to see, because in your head, it's always fluffy, these round edges, mm-hmm. and it's everything's good. But I mean, once you sketch them down or write them down, they basically suck when I wake up in the morning. I take that 1% and I give it to my crew or to anyone. And well, maybe most of them suck as well, but maybe there's one little seed that's really, really good that we can work with, and that's enough.
I just wanted to take a second and remind you, if you do have scenarios to write down, make sure you take note of them now, because we're going to be going around in a few minutes and collecting them. So you're talking about vocabulary, you're talking about tools, you all have a different way of working, and we're all kind of working towards the same goal, right, which is to get a great user experience, to get a great design. What is the importance, you know, I'm interested to hear the importance of tools and the kinds of tools that you use in your different environments to achieve that goal. Like, can design be a tool to help us get unstuck?
Design is definitely a tool to help us get unstuck. I think that, well, I love this topic because I think one of the worst things that are out there today that's been discussed here as well is the gap between the designers and the developers. I actually think that everybody is the designer, because design is both the process and the goal. Mm-hmm. So we just come from different perspectives. And I mean, to me, design is also business. It couldn't be design if you take the business side out of it. So if everyone works with design towards a common goal instead of focusing on what's the difference between two disciplinaries is, we probably should achieve better results. And I think focus on the common factors instead, like culture, process, and organization, instead of looking at the differences, because there are 1,001 differences. Try to find those 3 or 4 common factors and build on those to get forward.
I was going to say, I would actually say, you know, a lot of times people get out there and say, oh, you need to involve designers more in your process. And the design team is in, you know, you sort of set up a wall right there by talking about yourselves as distinct from the other groups. Instead, what you can sort of start doing is using the deliverables of design, you know, experiences that are useful, usable, and desirable, what have you, engaging. You can use the methodology of design, design as a problem-solving process, what's kind of coined design thinking, the sort of rapid prototyping, build to think, rooted in empathy and what's happening in the real world process. And then the third thing you can use is design principles, so ways to make meaning out of complex information, ways to manage complexity, ways to build hierarchy, to tell stories and things like that. And you can do all those things without calling it design and saying, hey, I'm here to be your designer and we need to design this thing, right? Just add value via design principles, processes, and deliverables, and people will sort of buy into that. I think one of the most useful things I've done when I spent 2 years at eBay and kicked off a couple new product lines for that company. I was responsible for the design side. But the way I sort of got buy-in from the strategic team and the mergers and acquisitions team, which was a very separate unit, right? Like, designers never talked to M&A guys. It was worlds of difference. But we were looking at a potential acquisition in international space. And in order to kind of get my head around what we were doing, I went through with Babelfish and did a slide-by-slide screenshot of this product and translated every word on it. And then I created this document. It was like a 50-page PowerPoint where every single thing was translated, and it kind of gave you the scope of what is this thing, what are we dealing with. It was huge value for everybody involved in the team. And then after that, people were like, oh, this guy's valuable, right? He does things. And then we got more into strategic decisions about should we actually buy this, what should we build, what should we buy. It turned into a whole new business unit, etc. But if I didn't do that sort of groundwork to add value, and I didn't say this is a design process. I don't even know if it was a design process, but it was a way of using my training as a designer to wrap my head around the problem and help define the problem. Then you sort of get brought in and you go from there. So don't be afraid of the menial sort of tasks. Maybe they're outside of what designers really do. It's about adding value.
One of the other things that I learned from open source is that at least software development, and I think this is true for a lot of things, anything where there are people involved building things together, is that it's all a political process. So building software is a political process. And as such, you need to really be thinking of everybody's interests and what they have at stake and why they care about certain features or certain ideas more than other things. Mm-hmm. And if you can reinterpret, you know, sort of as Jeffrey said, and listen to what their real needs are, what they're really saying, and why they're championing something so much, like, you know, if they're feature doesn't get in there, then their whole unit goes away and they lose their job. That's a serious concern. Mm-hmm. So you want to be able to interpret that and understand that. And I think work towards meshing that into your overall process. I think an interesting anecdote came from this large software company that builds database software, was trying to go open source, and they tried to institute a wiki within their organization, just a private internal wiki. And what ended up happening was exactly that, where the marketing folks had their sort of geography of the wiki, and the engineers had their geography of the wiki, and then the business folks had their geography. And so there were these three different areas that absolutely had to talk. The whole purpose of the wiki was to get them to collaborate, and yet they actually had totally separate spaces where they weren't talking. Now, not only even that, but when they would actually, when they were encouraged to go and edit and read each other's pages, they would actually delete everything that the other side had done. So there clearly wasn't this sort of intermediation, this political process going on. It was pure totalitarianism. And I think it's really important actually to have someone within an organization think about that and realize that in terms of trying to wikify your organization such that everybody has a little piece of the pie, that there is an understanding, shared understanding, and again, going back to like the idea of trust in organization, that communication is flowing freely.
I believe in small teams, and if you work at a place with really large groups, maybe you can subdivide into small teams. Mm-hmm. If you can do that, it's really helpful. At HappyCog, we have very small teams work on projects, and we have an editorial director on every project. Every time we can get away with it, we have an editorial director work on every project, even if it's primarily a design project. And that person works with the information architect. The information architect works with the designer, and there's constant feedback loops between all the groups. The developer doesn't just come in at the end. The developer is kept aware of everything going on. They may be kind of bored by it. They may think, just let me know when I have to code something. But they're still involved because they're part of the decision-making team. So there's this small group with user focus, language focus, and everybody's the other thing I think that we do that kind of helps us. Our information architect is almost a flight attendant or a prostitute. I'm not sure how to, but to the stakeholders who don't actually know what needs to get done, but need to feel that they were heard. So it's kind of the same thing again. And instead of using a wiki, we actually talk to all these people who have very strong opinions and feelings about things. They don't actually know anything about design or web design or users or how websites are built. Some of them don't even use a computer, but they have very strong opinions. We make them feel loved. Okay. And when they feel loved and listened to, and all this process goes on for like a month before we show any design to anybody, then we have a lot of buy-in. We already have people feeling it, so it's getting back to, again, trust. And it sounds manipulative, and it's a little manipulative, but it's mostly about listening. So it's really about honesty and communication, because not only do we try to figure out what the users of the site need, we have to figure out about these other users, the people who have to feel good when they talk to their golfing partners about the site they just spent money on. So they're users too, even if they don't actually use the site in the same way as anyone, another human. Mm-hmm. They have to feel good, and we have to get them on board so they won't mess things up for us later.
As a former information architect, I've never actually felt good about being called a prostitute, but that was
that's the love part he was talking about. I'm sorry. Can I say one last thing? I think the things that you're talking about in small teams actually apply in big teams. Everybody sort of thinks that, you know, the small teams work a certain way, big teams work a different way. It's the same basic principles and issues, just magnified, right? So what you have to give love in the small team, you got to give a whole lot of love in the larger team. A lot more hugging, basically. Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to say, if you do have a question still in your hand, you can pass that to the ends of the aisles, to either end of the room, and someone will be around to pick it up.
Can I add something, Liz?
Absolutely.
Because I was just thinking, I think that getting unstuck in a smaller team is much more easier than getting unstuck in a larger organization. But I think that's one of the obstacles that we're facing. Yeah. I hope these guys want to join us, but me and Kelly are actually working on that right now, and we have no clue on how to get large organizations to get unstuck. But we think...
I thought it was love. Didn't we just answer
it? It is love. It's mistakes. It's love. It's culture. It's the common factors that everyone share that in that organization that we have to build upon, we believe. But we also have to find them and try to make it work on a tactical level. And I think that's going to be really, really hard.
So come to help us figure out what gettingunstuckmeans.com and share your thoughts.
Thank you.
Trademark Jeffrey. 2007.
That's a good idea.
So before we go to questions from the audience, I wanted to ask about, it sounds like what you're talking about is selling design, right? So getting unstuck in a large corporation involves selling design, right, to the counterparts, or not, or just love.
I used to think that. I don't think that anymore. So we used to kind of go around and do a roadshow. This is why design's valuable. This is why you should involve us. We want to be involved strategically. I don't do that anymore. I just add value whatever way I can and sort of get in there and do my design thing without them possibly even knowing I did a design thing, right? I just help the product get better.
Well, when you're with, thank you. But when you're with a small company, right, and you're selling design to potential clients, clients trust process. And maybe large companies, you can add value without saying, well, here's my process. And it looks like, you know, one through steps one through seven. But can you sell that kind of idea? Can you add value when you're, pitching work without talking about process?
Okay. Well, we write proposals that have like really long, detailed process stuff to reassure business people that we're going to have a process and it's going to be laborious and there's going to be lots of deliverables, milestones, and that's the part of writing the proposal that I hate so much that I usually don't do it.
I did 10 years of consulting and I never did that. Mine was timeline. We'll get some stuff on this day. We'll iterate. We'll get some more stuff on this day. We'll call it good.
When I say I don't do it, I just mean I have someone else do it for me. But we do it because that's a reassurance. It's a reassurance.
We don't. We try to like get to know the clients before, take them out, party with them, and see if we're on a personal level, then we can make the business work. But if it's only a business level, then it won't be a long-term relationship. So we just don't spend time doing it. And also we try to have really, really simple processes like explore, think, create, act in an iterative way. That's basically it.
Okay.
Because we all need to understand
But nothing's going to reassure a client more than saying like before and after of what you've done before, right? So like if you say, hey, this is what we did for these guys. This is where they started. This is where they ended. Fuzzy stuff happened in the middle because it's always fuzzy, right? It's never going to be that exact process with each client. So I think that's, in my experience, that sells it a lot more than the reassurance of having a process.
Well, we look at what their problems are and we tell them, here's what we think your problems are. Here's what we think we'd like to do for you, but we'll know more when we get to know you. Meantime, the whole time we're communicating, flirting, figuring out if we like them and they like us. I agree with you 100%. If it feels like a love match, and we've got this good thing up the top, which usually has some tough love, like why what they're doing is wrong, why they need our help, we modestly think they need our help. Then at the end of that, there's all this like, almost like fine print of like, there's three rounds of design, there's three rounds of this, and the reason we do that, is to not get stuck in seven rounds of design or 18 rounds of wireframes. And it's just in a contract. It's more or less a contract at the end. It's like, sign this, send us some money, and we'll go.
And no one reads the fine print anyway.
I would add to that. First, I think people now, especially if you're a consultant, are really being hired more for your way of thinking than your process. I think that it's actually more important that you're able to adapt to things that come up as they come up because things are really fuzzy now. You can't go through like, you know, 8 or 10 months of design process to get to a product. In fact, a lot of the consulting that we do is actually on building communities. And part of the work that we do is about understanding the environment that you're in. So what's actually going on around you? Then we talk about the product, you know, how can you actually make the product better through the things that are going on in the environment as well as what kind of, communications are happening within a community. So the third part is that community communication stuff and being open, being available, being accessible. And so these are ongoing iterative things that have a lot of evolution that go through them. The other thing to think about is to really hire your clients. I know it sounds difficult, but the reality is that if you have the turn of mind that actually can solve problems for people and you see an opportunity where you can help someone out, that's a lot better fit than people who sort of call you out of the blue and say, oh, I have some general vague notion about what you do. Please save us from ourselves. Because that's just going to end badly.
Yeah, I'm just going to bring up one last thing on the process thing. I'm going to be deliberately vague here. At unnamed large corporation, we had unnamed large design agency come and give us a pitch. And they talked for about an hour about their process. They put up big things on the walls and showed, here's how we're going to build models of your users. Here's how we're going to analyze this. And, I was in the room with a whole bunch of business people on the brand side, people on the development side. And everybody walked out of that room and said, man, that seems really tedious and laborious. There's no way we're going to hire these guys. Because they never talked about our problem. They never talked about what we needed or how we needed it. They just talked about their process the whole time. Right? And it's like, okay, well, you guys want to just do this fancy pants user experience process, but what about, you know, the people that are actually footing the bill? Yeah. What are the results? What are we going to get? So
that's what we basically do. Because when we talk to clients, we always assume that they don't know what they want, and we certainly don't know it. So what we try and convince them and what we try and be good at is understanding context, their context. It's like I went to sketch school years ago, and we had to study like for 2 weeks everything but the object we were sketching, and it actually turned out that I drew the object better by studying the in-betweens. And so basically that's what we do. We tell our clients that we understand your context, but we don't know yet what we'll design for you. But eventually, as we understand the context more and more, it'll show itself.
That's a nice, it's a nice analogy.
Just one more thing to that. In terms of selling or in terms of convincing, we had a speaker trainer actually come to our space, Citizen Space in San Francisco, to do a full day workshop. Her name is Laura Dulles. And one of the most sort of poignant things that she said that I thought was really, really valuable and interesting, and she trains lawyers and she trains people who give pitches to VCs and so on. And she was training our little group that day, was that when you're speaking, the most important thing that you can really focus on is not about necessarily what you're saying, because that's not really the most important thing. It's actually how you make the audience feel. Can you actually make them feel, you know, like you're in a one-on-one dialogue with them? Are you actually there with them? Or are you just talking about yourself? And I think in this case, the process that you're talking about was really all about this design firm and how smart they were. And I think that that feeling just, you know, that's what resonates. It doesn't really matter what slide you show or what information's up there. It's really about that connection. And that's what resonates. And so I think, you know, in terms of this overall process, the politics and all that, it's really important to think about that when talking about your ideas, and that it's just as important that people are listening to you.
Yeah. Well, you can't tell a story if you don't know your audience, right?
Yeah.
I was going to say one other thing. I saw proposals from another agency, and they were very, very boilerplate. And you could tell they just opened Microsoft Word and kept switching the names in. And that's not a way to get business. I think I agree with everything that's being said. The way to get business is to actually tell the person what you think their problem is or what area you think their problem's in, and that you'll know more as you get to know more about them.
Yeah. Or just have a conversation with them to define the problem, right? I mean, people come in and they start pitching solutions. So, you know, what are you solving, right? We don't even know the problem yet, so.
It's time for the lightning round. Okay. Chris, did you have music to go with that?
No.
Okay. So thanks for everyone for these. We probably have a few more. There seem to be about 150 here, so we probably won't get through them all. But we're going to do our best to get through some of them. So how this works is this. We're going to do – excuse me one moment. Okay. So these guys have 1 minute to respond to each of your stuck scenarios. And I would just say that it's kind of like a game show. Whoever sort of responds first gets to answer it. And I wish we had buzzers, but the store was closed this morning. So you ready? Okay. Here we go. My company hosts the sites and apps we build. Over the last 8 years, this means much of our work is repeat work, slapping on a new coat of paint, functionality on these sites on an annual basis. We're stuck because the setup doesn't allow enough time to do truly new work.
Quit.
Change center.
Excellent. There are points for...
That wasn't a minute.
Okay, next. Designs and prototypes become demos and products instead of conversations into feedback loops. The pros of this, it might like new designs. The cons, the product is never on target. How do we get management to say refine it versus ship it?
Repeat the question, please. No, I think is the prototype built before anybody ever sees it? I mean, are you going to management with the finished prototype and saying, here you go, you know, yes or no? In that case, that's their only option to say, yes, ship it or don't ship it. If you kind of come in there early on, say, here's what we're doing, get them involved in the process, make them part of the build-to-think mentality of creating a prototype, then they're naturally in the revision flow and in the refinement flow rather than having to make a yes or no decision. So I think it goes back to that continuous feedback loop. Go off in your corner, make a prototype, and then say, voila. Of course, they're going to be like, okay, do it, don't do it, right? But kind of involve them a little bit in whatever way you can. Each environment's different.
Agreed.
I would also add to that, simplify. Basically, if you can't meet the deadlines, you're probably building too much. Also, you've got to have clear vision on what it is you're actually solving. If you don't, then your scope's just going to spiral out of control and you're never going to be able to meet your deadlines. So if at all possible, I mean, again, go through that political process as fast as possible and build stuff and get it out as soon as possible.
So I must say, these are not the point of view of the panelists before I read this next question. Some clients focus on his or her preferences as opposed to the targeted consumer. In other words, they screw everything up. Clients suck. How do I control this and steer it back to the consumer?
Quit.
No, I'm just teasing.
We talked before, someone was talking about picking your clients. Not everyone has that ability, so... if you do have the ability, if you're lucky enough, and right now there's so much work out there that you can, in many cases, just say no to a lot of jobs until you get the right one.
Actually, so another way to do this, and again, you know, coming from open source, the best thing you can do is actually getting a product out there to the users and, like real people, you know, people that actually exist, and have them use it in front of your client. And basically prove and show that your client has no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, and it also seems that they're not really involved in the process and that maybe you should work on your arguments on why you take the decisions you take. Because I think like design is about making decisions as well, and you need to be comfortable with them so that you can tell your clients why you made them.
A free usability test in front of them is really valuable. Videotape people not being able to use the product, not knowing what it's for, and then say, okay, so should we ship?
The other way to go about it, if you don't want to go feeding people from the computer, is just literally acknowledge their goals and put them in a column that says business goals, and then make another column that says user needs, and say, okay, here's the two things we need to address. So their things are on the plate. We're not ignoring them. We're including them. But there's also these other things. You know, and theoretically, they should acknowledge that they have customers. If they don't, they won't have customers. So,
great. Next, how do we explore new ideas and innovate when management needs us to stay on budget? There's no room or time to take risks or make mistakes.
Volunteer to do extra work, even though that's probably not an answer that you like. Work late. No boss ever complains that you're working late and doing extra work. It's also a good way, by doing that, you'll also be involved in more meetings. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that you'll be seen more as a decision maker and a go-getter, and they'll trust you and listen to you more, and they'll be more likely to listen to your advice later on.
Yeah. No one's going to give you resources the first time around until you prove yourself, right? So that first few times, yeah, it's extra time, it's extra work, it's on top of something, but then they see the value add and they say, oh, we want this, then you can be like, well, this is what it takes, right? And then you'll get those resources.
Yeah, I also think being as resourceful as possible. I mean, resources come out of the most obscure places. This is where we really counsel our clients to be part of the community that they serve so they can actually see what's going on and pull resources out of what already exists. So it isn't about pulling money out of thin air. It's actually about seeing what's out there and seeing what resources you haven't even acknowledged yet.
And constraint is actually a good thing in a lot of times. So if you don't have resources, that actually might mean you do something better, more focused, more targeted, and voila.
Time. Next, the only team member of a group of three with web standards accessibility knowledge. How do I teach and explain?
Repoint them to alistapart.com.
show the value of it, right? Like, what does it mean? You know, what am I getting out of this? They won't care unless there's something in it for them, which goes back to some of the things that Jeffrey was saying. Everybody's got a perspective on things. Frame it in their context, right? So based on the way you see the world, here's how this fits in and what it gets you.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote Designing with Web Standards for your boss or your client. There's some good stuff for developers in the back, kind of okay stuff in the back, but mainly it's for your boss to get, oh, I see, so I won't be sued for being inaccessible and people can actually use it and I won't have to spend as much money on my server. You know, they like, as dull as it sounds, I won't have to spend as much money on bandwidth. Is huge. It like that sells.
Hey, I think also, again, bringing in, you know, the reasons why you care about something, why you might be passionate, might not resonate exactly. So you've got to, again, be able to come to a story that can be repeated back to you. And so in the case of especially like web standards and accessibility, going out and bringing people in and saying, here, you know, we're going to sit down with someone who actually has these issues or has these concerns. It's not going to come from my mouth. I want you to hear it from somebody else. Actually removes you from that story and allows them to just focus on what you're really saying.
If you were on the accessibility panel yesterday morning, there was a very quick video clip of John, who has leukemia and is blind. And he went to all the medical websites to get information about his leukemia, and it was all inaccessible to him. And you watch that 30-second clip, and if you're a human being, you'll get it, and you'll never want that to happen again to anybody.
Yeah, and so I guess that points to something really important. Have a real need behind it beside just personal preference, like, you know, or dogma. A lot of times people sort of get entrenched and it must be this way. Well, sometimes it must not. Yeah, you get stuck. That's another point. I mean, getting stuck doesn't necessarily mean your team's not moving forward. It might be you're entrenched in a certain way of viewing the world. And a video like that is a great way to open your eyes to and empathize with what's really happening.
I also think that just by using the net, because I think that most people has bumped into those issues of trying to convince someone about web standards or design or whatever, and there are tons of people on the net, so you can just kind of, you don't have to reinvent the wheel yourself and rethink everything. Just use the resources that are out there and spend time on designing instead.
Time. So I just wanted to give a little bit of credit to you guys because you've designed your index cards and some of them are kind of really cool. So the next question is, we have a multi-million dollar project everyone agrees privately is doomed to failure. Management won't kill it because of how much money we've spent. How do you convince people to kill such a monster?
Quit.
But do you actually have to kill the monster or can you tame it and kind of have it live in your closet for a little while? I think that's maybe something to do is there's all these mythologies of knights going in and kind of slaying the monster and out comes a princess. So there's an opportunity there, I think. If you've got a lot of money and you've built something, it's not all bad. I can't imagine it's all bad. If it's all bad, then yeah, you might want to quit. But there's probably some golden nugget in there that you can sort of latch onto and build from there.
You can use it as a demo of what doesn't work. And here's what I mean. The Apple.
You can put it on a panel.
About the Apple stores, and they were very successful because they first built prototype stores that failed. They built prototype stores, and they walked in, and it was all based on their product categories, and it wasn't at all based about lifestyle, user needs, nothing. So they went, oh, my gosh, we've really – they used stronger language, I'm sure. They said, we've really fouled things up, and we're in trouble. So, but they looked at all the money they'd spent as very good learning, and as a result, they have very successful stores now.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, the biggest thing there, if you got a couple million dollars, I mean, fail very, very quickly.
Time.
And rapidly.
Next. Where's my IA? As an IA, I design wireframes. When I pass it on to the design team, my IA disappears and the designers redesign it, the features and functionality. What to do?
Talk to each other.
There you go.
Have meetings.
Now, understand what each person does. So, I mean, if you're the IA and you assume all these guys are doing is painting in the boxes, and if you're a designer and you assume all these guys do is draw boxes, then you're never going to go anywhere, right? Like, understand what's the point of the box. And also, to your point, talk. Learn the language of the other side. I mean, one of the things that I've seen in annotations of wireframes is actually calling out the prioritization of the content on there so that a graphic designer can build a visual hierarchy around it, right? This is the most important feature. It probably needs to have the highest visual contrast, visual weight, and sort of go from there with a shared language.
Yeah, you might want to think maybe a wireframe is the wrong thing for this particular designer. Maybe they need I forget what these things are called, but it's sort of exactly what you were saying, left to right, the most priority, least priority, and then let the designer interpret and then have a conversation about it before it gets shown to the creative director.
Yeah, the bigger question there is, why are they ignoring it? And, you know, what can you do to actually work with them to actually, again, have that shared language? And maybe it is actually about changing your architecture for collaboration such that you're actually working together at the same time. So you're not going away.
Two zingers for you.
I've been unemployed since November and have taken on one contract. How can I motivate myself to get out of my comfy, comfy bed?
Yahoo's hiring.
Quit.
Everyone on the team wants to make the decisions. How can we get decisions to stick and move on?
Can you say that again?
Everyone on the team wants to make the decisions. How can we get decisions to stick and move on?
Open what does conflict. The boss say? Hmm? Do you have a boss? Sometimes the boss has to step up to the leadership role and be the leader, even though they may not be popular.
I would create a persona that is the user And then when we can't take decisions together, I would just point it at the persona and let that persona take the decision, because it's the user that we're designing for.
Well, you can actually bring in a real person, too.
Wow.
And they can sit there.
Well, right? Paperwork. Well,
not all the time.
Paperwork's much better,
maybe not
actually.
At the time
paper,
when you're stuck. Yeah.
People? No, paper. I would actually say open
What's
conflict.
Flat, say?
Yeah. If you want to make a flat Stanley, it's the original version. So have open conflict. Have an open dialogue about it. Everybody gets their issues out. You can actually get a decision that sticks. If everybody doesn't get heard, or people just sit there quietly and like, this is never going to work, and they leave the meeting with that mindset or leave the process with that mindset, they're never going to buy into it. They're never going to hold themselves accountable. You're not going to be able to hold them accountable. So you got to have an open dialogue where you get everything out there, right? And then
form
just go
a build
team
something,
decision.
You know?
Right. We have a client who doesn't listen very well and resists the design process. We want to help them and fire them at the same time. Response?
Don't pitch your process. Add value. I mean, I think we've tried to cover on that a little bit ago.
You know, yeah, I mean, it really is about, I think, delivering and showing results. I mean, it's really challenging, though, when you do have a client that's kind of like, you know, not interested in these things. And maybe it is time for a field trip where you take them out and, you know, walk them down the reality and let them see what's actually going on out there.
Or check yourself. I mean, are you really delivering a kick-ass thing that's getting this person excited or not? Or are you giving them some bland stuff? Maybe they're upset with you and they don't trust you because you're not giving them something to get them excited about. Right? So don't like constantly point the finger at the client. Look, do the Michael Jackson move. Look in the man in the mirror.
You're saying grab yourself.
Although not currently. He's not looking too good these days. I take that back, actually. Whoa. Sad. Whoa.
Okay. We have probably 125 or so other index cards. So if you want to stick around, you know, we'll try to figure out a way to make these public somehow. It might be interesting to have these exposed. You can see all the unstuck problems. For now, with a few minutes left, I wanted to turn it back to the panel and ask you to wrap up with one or so tips on how to get unstuck.
Okay. Listen, have dialogue. Listen, yeah. Listen to what people are saying. Articulate simple goals. Make sure and see if other people agree with those goals and find simple ways of saying them.
Yeah, I think communication is key. This open feedback loop, and then you know, I find myself I'm always pretty resistant at first when somebody gives me sort of a different thing than I was thinking about, or that I had, and I got this whole thing in my head. This is how it's going to work. This is what the process is. This is what this guy's going to do. That's what this guy's going to do, and voila. And then at first I'm sort of resistant to hearing other than that, but then I'll go back and bring that in. It actually always amounts to be better. So just being open and, you know, yes, sometimes you do have a good idea and you should hold on to it, but a lot of times that idea can get better and better and better. So.
Yeah, I think actually one of my personal biggest challenges, is that I tend to be at first negative. And I think that for my own self, what I need to work on in terms of my stuckness is actually taking the approach of saying yes and. So when someone offers something or offers feedback or whatever and it's not obviously great to me, I need to say yes and here are some ideas about how to make it better, or yes, that's a great idea, but here's some feedback on that. And being able to really take that feedback openly. And just as I encourage open documentation and getting everything out there as fast as possible, you know, for my own sake, to be able to take in ideas and be open to whatever comes.
Okay. I think that you have to, this is a concrete tip, I believe, to always have someone in your team when you're working on a project that only has to focus on the solution, because the project is just a tool for creating something and creating something that will continue, actually get birth once the project is finished. Mm-hmm. So have someone not dealing with the project factors and just focusing on the solution. And also focus on common factors instead of differences. And, get a tattoo and be fearless.
A persona is a good thing, too. I think of a person. There was a panel called Writing Better yesterday, and one of the speakers was talking about writing everything in email because it's less frightening, but also it sort of puts you in the mindset that you're talking to an individual person. If you can think of the project that you're working on not as the people that you have to work with, some of whom you like a lot and others that you don't like that much, and instead think about Mary or Jim, whoever it is that's going to use it, and what their needs are, and just keep that person in mind like you would if you were writing a birthday card or something else, something really personalized. That can help you keep focus.
And actually, one more thing. Lane Becker, good friend of mine, gave me some really, really good advice. Basically, if you're ever working on a project or trying to work with a client, think about what it's going to be like to go out after you've had success for beers with that client or with your coworkers. Think about what that looks like. Think about what you're actually celebrating. What did you actually get done? What did you achieve that you haven't done yet? And I think that really helps you focus again on finding that set, that the goals and being successful.
Great.
Well, may I say one more thing?
Of course.
I think this is really important, and that is to actually, because we try to find the common context to get the team to work, and I think make corp or management really take responsibility for culture and process and organization, and yeah, put them against the wall. That works for us. That's what we do with our clients. And it's good. They like it.
So on that note, I wanted to thank our assistants, Alyssa Walker and Lydia Mann and Coy Vin, for giving us the idea about index cards, and of course, our fantastic panel. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.